Now, there are many prophets in the Old Testament, but there's only one, Elijah. He's a human dynamo who kind of bursts onto the scene out of nowhere, and he goes out of the picture even more dramatically. Chariots of fire and all of that. He's the chief among the prophets, appearing with Jesus and Moses at the Transfiguration, identified with John the Baptist, and, as we heard only a couple of weeks ago, referenced by James in his letter as a powerful prayer. And over the next few weeks, we're going to be looking at something of the story of Elijah. And as often been the case this year, it seems, I'm the warm-up act, introducing and setting the scene for the series to come. First, a bit of history to set Elijah in context. And here, these maps might just help with the geography and the politics. It's the years 800s BC, and the great kingdom of David and Solomon has long since gone. It's split into two different parts, and if I can indicate here, this area in pink is the southern kingdom of Judah based on Jerusalem as its capital, and to the north in sky blue is the kingdom of Israel, the other kingdom, and Israel is ruled over by King Ahab. And there are three main locations to be aware of. You'll see that little box at the top is blown up in larger size on the right. And the Kerith Brook is where, which we'll hear about in a moment. Zarephath is up here between Tyre and Sidon. And then there's Mount Carmel, which does come into the story, but not yet. So, to strengthen his position politically, Ahab has been looking north, up here, to this area to the north, or here as it's known as where the Sidonians live, the people of Sidon. We may know those people better as the Phoenicians. And Ahab is looking to form an alliance to build his power base. And part of the deal that he makes with them is that he shall marry a Sidonian woman, Jezebel, and that he will facilitate the practice of her religion within his country. She's a worshipper of Baal and the female counterpart Asherah, and they were the gods respectively of rain and fruitfulness, fertility, and by extension, life and death. So there's a real edge in Elijah's prophetic ministry in this chapter, treading as it does on Baal territory. Rain, drought, famine, life and death. There will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years, except at my word. And it might be worth saying just a word or two about prophets as well here. There are basically two kinds of prophets that appear in the Old Testament. There are those who foretell the future, and there are a number of examples over Christmas that we shall be celebrating how certain prophets foretold the coming of the Messiah, Jesus. And Micah is one, with Bethlehem identified as the location, and Isaiah is another who talks about the virgin shall conceive and bear a son. And there are lots more. But there's another kind of prophet, which is those who foretell. People who are not talking about the future as much as talking about the present. And they are speaking to the people around them. They're telling the truth as it is, telling it as it is. They are speaking truth to power and putting themselves in harm's way by challenging those who abuse their power. And a couple of illustrations there. Amos is one in the Northern Kingdom, around 800, and then there's Jeremiah in the Southern Kingdom, talking to power and how things are going drastically wrong within their country. And Elijah combines both of these. He's both foretelling the aspects of his ministry which are looking forward to the coming of the Messiah, and there are also ways primarily in which he is talking to Ahab. And he's calling him to account for deserting the God of Israel and allowing corruption to spread like a cancer throughout the land. And so throughout Elijah's ministry, there is this kind of underlying big question to Ahab, which is, who is God around here? Who is the God who you're going to serve? Are you serving the God of Israel, God revealed to his people? Or are you serving the God of your wife Jezebel, the Baal, whom you've imported into this land? And one further footnote, perhaps, before we launch into the story itself, and that's to do with the name of God. You may well recall that when God called Moses out of the burning bush, he revealed his name as being I Am, or I Am Who I Am. And that comes across in translated from the Hebrew for as Jah or Yah or Yahweh or Jehovah, depending on which translation you're working from. And it's not for nothing that Jesus identifies himself as the I Am, uses that phrase over and over again. Before Abraham was, I am the way, the truth, and the life, and so on. And he's deliberately identifying himself there with the God who revealed himself to Moses, the God who throughout the Old Testament is calling his people together, calling them to live as his witnesses, to demonstrate who his character. And the answer that Elijah is looking for in this big question to Ahab is clued in his own name. Elijah. Two parts to that word. Eli, meaning my God, and Jah, or Yah, or Yahweh, Jehovah, the God of Israel. In other words, Elijah's very name is saying, my God is Yahweh, Jehovah. My God is the God revealed to Israel. Who's your God, Ahab? And that sort of challenge comes to a head next week. So to the first episode, which is going to the Brook of Kerith. After Elijah's delivered this bombshell to Elijah, there will be no rain. The Lord tells him to hide by the Brook Kerith, and as we saw where that's located, somewhere where there's running water and miraculous provision via the ravens. And the ravens are quite interesting here. One of the commentators has suggested that perhaps they weren't birds at all, but the word Hebrew word is very similar to the name of a non-Jewish tribe, small tribe that lived in that area, known today as the Black Arabs. I've only come across one commentator that suggested that. Almost all the others stick with the birds. But it's very significant that ravens are on Moses' blacklist of animals that are unclean. So whichever way you look at it, Elijah has been provided from some kind of unclean source, whether it's a people group or whether it's the ravens. And sometimes God answers our prayer and meets our need from unlikely sources, perhaps even in ways that we might disapprove of, unclean means. And through a time of doubt, of drought and famine of the word as well as of food and water, God may take us outside our comfort zone to unusual places for sustenance and provision and show us that he is there too. Just think of Joseph going to Egypt, or Moses in the desert, or Daniel in Babylon, Jesus in the desert, Paul going out into Arabia, places of discomfort where they discover that God is, and God is providing for them. And it's an old and familiar story now, but maybe not everyone's heard it, but you may be aware of Corrie ten Boom complaining about fleas in the block of the Ravensbrück concentration camp where she and her sister were sent. Ravensbrück, Ravensbrück. There's a bit of serendipity for you. And she needs her more saintly sister, Betsy, to explain that actually the fleas are God's provision, because the fleas keep the guards away. And therefore they have more opportunity within their block to worship and to pray, to read the scriptures together. I wonder if there are fleas or ravens or some sort in our own lives at the moment that we may need to recognize as being God's provision for us. So we move on to the next part of the story. Nothing lasts forever in this life, and the brook dries up at Kerith, and Elijah has to listen for the word of God afresh in the new circumstances that have arisen. And nothing stands still in our own lives. And as circumstances change, there's constantly the need to be listening to what God is saying to us in the new circumstances that develop. For Elijah, it's a long journey from Kerith up to this town of Zarephath, way up north between Tyre and Sidon. He is to go and hide in plain sight in the midst of the enemy. And he's directed to the most unlikely person to be of any help. He goes to this widow, and in those days, widows were a byword for abject poverty. She's also a Sidonian, a Phoenician woman, presumably a worshipper of Baal, or surrounded by people who worship Baal. And she's also a widow who's down to her very last meal. So with some nerve, Elijah goes up and asks her to provide a meal for him. I think I would have sent him packing. Don't know about you. But there's some vestige of faith in this woman. She acknowledges that Elijah is a man of God and that his God is alive and active. And she receives what God is saying to her through Elijah. When he says, "Do not be afraid." How many times do we hear that in the Bible? Do not be afraid. The jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the land. So it was, day by day, there was just enough oil and flour to make food for the household to eat. And maybe you hear there an echo of the experience of manna in the desert, where there was just enough manna for the day, and God provided for his people there. So day by day, God provides here for Elijah and the widow and the household. Just enough for the day. And you may have also caught something of a foretaste there of the feeding of the 5,000, where a miracle occurs when an insignificant person offers the little that they have, and it is transformed into enough. And Jesus referred to this episode with the widow of Zarephath when he was got up to preach in his hometown of Nazareth centuries later. Truly, he said, I tell you, no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time when the sky was shut up for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And you may recall that they tried to kill Jesus at that point because they got the message that in their arrogance, they were under God's judgment. There's a comment from someone called Dale Ralph Davis that God's grace is being extended beyond Israel because that grace had been ignored within Israel. It's a sobering personal word as well. If we go on despising his word, God may withdraw his light and allow us to walk in the darkness we seem to prefer. Elijah's learning that God is bigger than the chosen few. When I was in my early 20s, I attended a church in London that I thought was the bee's knees. It was a warm and welcoming congregation, very diverse, and there was also a warm, welcoming and wise vicar, who, of course, had been trained at Oak Hill. He'd then been a missionary in Burma, and there was so much to like. But looking back, very insidiously, there kind of developed an element of pride and even of prejudice within me that St. Mark's was holy ground and that we were the chosen few who had it all sewn up. And like Elijah, I had to learn over time that God the Holy Spirit was working in other people and other places too. And not always the ones I approved of. So we come to the final part of the story, and it takes us right into the kind of grief that's being experienced all over, not least in the Holy Land today, of mothers weeping for their children. And as with many of us facing a death of a loved one, there comes a debilitating sense of guilt, whether it's real or perceived. The woman said to Elijah, what do you have against me, man of God? Do you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son? What have I done to deserve this? Am I being punished because I've done something wrong? I've faithfully submitted to the word of your God, and see where it's got me. He has provided, but now he's confusing. He's protected, but now he's devastating. And it's often beyond our fathoming that there are times when God gives and times when God takes away. We can only cry out with Elijah, "Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy even on this widow I'm staying with by causing her son to die?" Not all prayer needs to be passive and resigned. There are people close to me who have been known to give God a very hard time as to why he's allowing certain things to happen. And Elijah is helpless, but he's not going to give up without a fight. And he stretched himself out on the boy 3 times and cried out to the Lord, "Lord, my God, let this boy's life return to him." And like the son of the widow of Nain, the boy lives again and is restored to his mother. But it hardly needs spelling out that we have here another foretaste of what it will be like when the Messiah comes. There's a foretelling here of the resurrecting of new life. The last enemy to be destroyed is death and its power broken. So the raising of the boy is a prophetic act. It's a sign like the raising of Lazarus, of Jairus' daughter. It's a foretaste of the day of resurrection. This is the power of the God of Israel. He not only withholds the rain and lets it come, he not only provides the food for the day, but he raises from the dead. He who raised Christ from the dead will also give life to your mortal bodies because of his spirit who lives in you. So Ahab, what's your response? Who is God around here? Who can command the rain to fall or to dry up? Who causes the crops to grow or fail? Who is the God who holds sway over life and death? Is it Baal, the rainmaker, supposedly worshipped by Jezebel? Or is it the God of Israel, whose word will one day become flesh and dwell among us, full of grace and truth? And the widow makes her decision. "Now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is truth."